live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you all over the world, driving in cabs, trucks, cars, sitting at home, listening in the evening when 99.9% of the people listen to this program, they download it. And we have a lot for you today. I'm going to talk about a leaf that is used because it is so powerful, yet you never hear about it. It is called the moringa, and I'll tell you about it. Also today, I'm going to talk about how green office environments are linked to higher cognitive function scores. Well, why not also have green home environments? And then saffron, without question the most expensive spice, is shown to reduce oxidative stress in metabolic syndrome patients. This is from Bargen University Medical Sciences in Iran. And then study shows association between breastfeeding and reduced risk of aggressive breast cancer from the Icahn School of Medicine, Washington University. Then there's an Amazonian brew. They have used it for a long time, and it could be the most powerful antidepressant ever discovered. So I'll share that with you from GreenMed Info. And loading up on fruit and vegetables in early adulthood pays off later. Scans after 20 years show healthier arteries from the Minneapolis Heart Institute. Plus today, commentaries. One commentary today is Swimming with the Debt Sharks from J.P. Scottile from Truthout. The other is Tourist of Empire, America's Peculiar Brand of Global Imperialism from William Astor, Tom's Dispatch. I'll also be taking a look at something that virtually no one knew, that members of Congress who sit on panels discussing mergers, acquisitions, and IPOs are allowed to then invest before the public in those very deals. Now, let's put it this way. Let's say that you had a deal and you went to your legislator and said, I'm going to start a new company and it's going to do X, Y, and Z, and here is some money. That would be considered illegal. But why is it that if it's done by a legislator without getting cash, but rather the option and the ability to buy stock, before the public knows, this is all insider information. It's legal. Even when they changed the law, they watered it down, and it's still legal. I'll show you about that. Let's begin. First up, I'm always interested in what good science is showing around the world. In my travels, and I've done a lot of traveling, I'm always interested in how people in the cities, in the suburbs, and then in the rural environment in the country live. The structure of their families, their belief systems, their values. And of those different environments, how are they doing? Who's doing best? And without exception, I have found in my travels that those living in the rural environments live the longest life, are the least stressed, and are the happiest. And I spent 5 years traveling throughout Europe at different times, in South America, Central America, the Caribbean, the Mediterranean countries, to try to find answers to this. And a lot of times I found the answers by speaking with people who had lived in the country, grew up in the country, but then moved because they became professionals, lawyers, bankers, engineers, to the cities. And then they told me what the transition meant and what price they paid for their modern living. And I always ask them when I'm in the country, what do you do for fatigue? What if you have a cut, a burn, a scrape, an infection? What do you do if someone has depression or a headache? All these different conditions that we suffer from, and more often than not, Americans will take a non-prescription or prescription medication. They don't. More often than not, they'll bring out something, a salve, a powder of some type and say, this is what we use. And then I take the information, I get as much information as I can from them, then I come back and I study the scientific literature. And lo and behold, pharmaceutical companies are going all over the world, every inch of every continent, where anyone has a long-term benefit from using some medicinal plant. What they are interested in is coming back and finding the active ingredient, patenting it, bring it out as a very expensive proprietary drug. And they've done this many times. Well, my answer is, why not just use the original product? You don't have to have it patented. Also, there's a certain conceit when you realize that the average plant, a potato, an orange, an apple, could contain anywhere from 75 to 500 different chemicals. Now, those chemicals are not there by accident. They serve a purpose. We call them phytonutrients, and then we break them into categories. And then once we find out what they do, then we say, well, this is a superfood because look at all the good stuff it does. Well, here's one that we can add to that list. M-O-R-I-N-G-A, moringa. Second word, oleifera, O-L-E-I-F-E-R-A. They're leaves. Now, why is this important? Because it does a whole lot nutritionally and medicinally for the person using it. And it is the following. It is an anti-tumor. It is anti-inflammatory, anti-ulcer, anti-spasmodic, anti-hypertensive. It is anti-diabetic, antibacterial, antifungal. And it's rich as a food source in many parts of the world. It's grown very inexpensively. The leaves retain most of the vitamins and minerals when they're dried. And where do they use it? Mainly in India and Africa. And they use it there to fight malnutrition. And the immature green pods, what are called the drumsticks, are prepared similarly to green beans. And it's loaded with nutrition. For example, in one serving of just the leaves, they found 92 different nutrients. They found complete amino acids, including 9 essential amino acids. It had vitamin C, B6, potassium, magnesium, iron, calcium, and vitamin A in good quantities. In fact, it had 272% of the daily requirement of vitamin A and 125% the value of calcium. Well, that makes it better than kale and puts it right up there with sea vegetables. And it's used mainly for what they call tired blood. We would call it anemia, but they also use it for arthritis and joint pain, rheumatism, for asthma, cancer, constipation, diabetes, diarrhea, stomach pain, intestinal ulcers, intestinal spasms, headache, heart problems, high blood pressure, kidney stones, fluid retention, thyroid disorders, and different viral, fungal, or bacterial or parasitic infections. It can reduce swelling. It is an aphrodisiac. It increases sexual desire. It boosts the immune system. It increases milk production in lactating women. In fact, one study in women found that taking 7 grams, that's a little over a teaspoon of moringa leaf powder every day for 3 months, increased blood antioxidant levels, and so it made a big difference. It's great for diabetic patients. 50 grams of moringa leaves to a meal reduce the rise of blood sugar by 21%, and it has strong anti-inflammatory properties. So they've used it in all different ways, and so it's just something that when something has so many universal qualities, it is so adaptogenic of immune function, mood, blood pressure. I just want you to know about it. In fact, it has a higher percentage of amino acids than soy. So it's considered to have the highest protein ratio of any plant so far identified. So that's good. It is indeed goes to the top of the list of superfoods. And in time, it'll be on the market. You'll be able to find it. Not so much easy now, but remember, this program is broadcast and countries all over the world. When I mention that one of the best things to have if you have cancer, any form of cancer, including blood cancers, like leukemias, would be soursop. Now, of course, it goes by other names, depending upon the country, like in Jamaica or in Barbados, Trinidad, where it's grown also. A lot of people call it a vanilla fruit. It's white. It has like a vanilla-ish taste. Has lots of seeds in it. And this flesh in there, if you scoop it out in a whole one that's the size maybe of an orange, you might get 3 or 4 tablespoons. And that is strong at killing cancer cells. But you can't find it. You'd be lucky once a year for 2 weeks at one of the food stores that deal in exotic fruits and vegetables to find one. And they're generally very expensive. Now, I grow them. And they're also in the family of cherimoya. In the United States, we call it a cherimoya, not a soursop. Slightly different. They're different varieties. And it takes a long time to get them to grow in the United States. Mine took 9 years before it finally bore fruit. But down there in Jamaica, they just grow like weeds. And I mentioned it, and lo and behold, I was flooded with comments. People, well, we have a lot of these growing. We have hundreds of trees on our property here in Jamaica in the mountains. How do we get it? And I gave them suggestions of how to. And these are not sprayed. People don't spray these. And they're grown naturally. I gave them ways of getting it exported out to check the different processes to get it imported into the United States and the ports of entry and to go through the different agencies, USDA, so they're doing it right. But I said, there's a huge market here for it. Well, indeed, there's a market for a lot of things we just don't have. If you ever had real, extra virgin, unfiltered olive oil, most of you would not recognize it. Now, going to Spain, going to France, going to Italy, a lot of the oil that is bottled and sold is a very light oil. Some of it's been processed, some not. And some isn't even olive oil. There's a lot of counterfeiting of oils. But it depends upon the type of olive, and there are hundreds of different varieties of olives. You can get an olive oil that's so rich, so healthy, so vibrant in its healing nutrients, and its monounsaturated fatty acids, that just 1 teaspoon a day would really go a long way towards balancing your body. But then you'd have to get by the taste, because it's really strong. I mean, if you put car oil and that extra virgin olive oil that I've tried side by side, you wouldn't know which is which. You really have to develop a taste for it. It's much like wheatgrass juice. Last night I was having my, I don't eat dinner, with rare exception, unless there's a special occasion. I have one meal, the rest of it's mainly snacking through the day on healthy snacks. For example, yesterday, slicing some avocado, marinating it in a rosemary. I like rosemary and lemongrass with lemon juice. So you put it in, you slice all the avocados. And we have 3 different varieties of avocados that are available now. By the way, on my Facebook, somewhere, you'll see photographs. And one of the photographs, you'll see me holding a giant, I'm talking about weighed over a pound, avocado. That's from the tree that I have a lot of avocado trees. But they start very small, and they'll frequently, after a storm, drop off. Dozens, little tiny things. And about the size of an egg. Well, of course, they're immature and they're not going to ripen. But the big ones that make it, that become strong, they just keep growing and growing and growing. I mean, they just get bigger and bigger. So the trouble is, you have to cap these trees at about 8 foot. Well, I didn't think about it because I never saw any avocados coming off of it. So I just let it grow. And lo and behold, one day when I finally was walking, I look down, here's an avocado. I mean, where'd that come from? I'm looking around. And I look up. Now, mind you, avocados are dark green. Well, the tree is dark green. and it had grown to be about 40 feet high, with the closest branch being 20 feet. So I got up the tree, climbed up the tree, and lo and behold, up there were about 300 large avocados. And they'll last a long time, by the way. They can last a long, long time. But it takes a long time to get them to where they're bearing fruit. And people give up on it. Never give up because your fruit tree doesn't bear fruit. What you have to do is make sure that you're giving it more fertilizer, not chemical fertilizer, natural fertilizer, preferably liquid natural fertilizer, around the base once a week for about 2 months. That's what I have found stimulates the growth. I had a plum tree that no plums grew on it for 7 years, and then one day there's little tiny plums, and then a month later there's 200 or 300 plums. And by having bees, and I really recommend people have bees if you can, if your zoning allows, and learn about bees, and never feed bees, never under any circumstances do what the entire bee industry does, and of course they do it completely wrong. They give them glucose solution. Well, that's like giving a baby glucose solution instead of giving a baby breast milk. So the bees die, and they just, what is it? I've talked with them. And it's rather strange to look in someone's eyes and say, you spraying neonicotinoids? Yeah, they spray them. You realize you've lost half your hive? Yeah, damn beehive collapse. What do you feed them in the wintertime when they have nothing to forage on? Remember, there's no food unless you give them some. Well, we give them glucose solution. And how long would you survive, sir, if all you had to eat each day was some glucose solution? Well, I don't know. Wouldn't you think if you own 400 hives and you've lost half of them, that you might want to change? And it's like talking to a brick wall. The entire industry is in denial, unless they're organic beehive, like myself. I'm an organic certified farmer and beehive person that I've had beehives my entire adult life. Happen now. Rule one, realize that little creature is not going to stop working. It has nothing protected in the winter. And so they sacrifice each other. Those that get on the outside of where the hive meet groups are going to freeze to death overnight, and their drones will throw them out. And then another group will freeze to death. And that's why if you don't protect the hive by putting up proper barriers around it to break the wind, then people wonder, gee whiz, we had a really tough winter and all the bees are gone. Wonder why? What if, let me ask every beehive owner, every bee owner in America, why don't you this year, why don't you and your family just stay naked and leave the doors open and turn off the heat and just go about your work all day, go outside, you know, but don't get dressed. If you live in Wisconsin, Buffalo, and there's 5 feet of snow, and it's 20 below zero, then maybe somewhere common sense will return to the American psyche. It sure as hell has been gone with monotheism, monoculture, corporate agriculture, genetic engineering, animal husbandry. It's all dumb and dumber and dumbest. You feed the bee organic, unheated, unprocessed honey. And how much? I've seen days when they've consumed a pound of organic honey per day. And guess how many dead bees? None. One hive lasting over 18 years. So there's a lot of myths about bees out there, and a lot of myths about farming, a lot of myths about agriculture. But if you want a bee to live, you feed it. If you want a human to live, you feed it. And if you think there's not a significance in what they eat and how long they live, then why don't you just live for the next year? Don't have a single healthy food. Just eat all your meals, all your beverages in fast food restaurants. Have your fried chicken and your hot dogs, your hamburgers, your pizzas, your colas, your coffee. Just have that for a year. But you can't cheat. Don't cheat. Only eat and drink that. And then let's see how, if you're still alive next year. And yet you feed your dog and cats out of box and canned crap, and you wonder why they're dying, and you give them vaccines they don't need or treatments, and you wonder why they're obese and their hair's coming out and they got dysplasia. Our dogs should be living 25 to 30 years. Our cats should be living 25 to 35 years. In other parts of the world where they actually feed them the right way, that happens. Where it's an inconvenience, here, so we feed them whatever and we don't look at what's in the box. And if you have a gluten intolerance, do you think your dog can't have a gluten intolerance? They can. Anyhow, I'm doing a documentary on natural pet health right now. It'll be ready in about a month. Now, diabetes, and by the way, I'm going to film in about 2.5 months. I'm going to film building your own backyard greenhouse. I'm going to film how to build your own beehive and put it together and where to get your bees and how to feed your bees and how to tend your bees. But not because you want their honey. Honey's insignificant. You let the bees keep their honey. It's for them. It wasn't meant for you. It was meant for the bee to eat its own honey. It's like drinking cow's milk. The cow's milk is meant for a little tiny heifer to gain 500 pounds in the next 8 months. It wasn't meant for humans. But it's the pollination that matters. One third of all the food in your entire life is because of those little bees. So we mistreat the bees, the colony collapse occurs, then where those foods going to be grown? Take away one third of all the food, and you're dealing with an awful lot of staples that we consume that we wouldn't have. And then what's going to happen to the price of food when so much land that is now being used, including California, our number one agricultural state, but Florida and Texas are the next two. Imagine what happens when there's no more capacity to grow foods in any quantity, a measurable quantity in California, and that's going to be happening over the next 5 years. There's no preparation for that. But there's going to be no water for most of the farming. 80% of the farming in California will be gone within 5 years. That's a whole lot of food. So my belief is, the future is self-sufficiency. I'm going to show you step by step in time-lapse photography and discussion and diagrams how you can build your own hydroponic house, have your own beehive, have all the vegetables and fruits, most fruits, even tropical fruits growing, even if you lived in Bismarck, South Dakota. So I'm going to have all that. And it'll be free, and it'll be there as a public service to help you. Because Big Agri is doing everything wrong, and the government only supports Big Agri. It does not support the small, sustainable, organic farmer. And you wonder why. Why can't the government ever do anything right? Why is it always about favoring those in power and challenging those who have none? But that's what they're doing. Now, diabetes risk is lower in those who supplement with chromium. A good article published in the Journal of Nutrition shows that you can lower your risk of type 2 diabetes among adults by using chromium supplements. They looked at 28,000 men and women enrolled in the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey over an 11-year period, and they found that those taking chromium had a substantial lessening of diabetic situations. So for all the pre-diabetics and diabetics, 200 micrograms a day of chromium. And also a nice article on saffron from the Bergen University of Medicine and Sciences, published in a journal of phytomedicine, showed that saffron, which is a very wonderful spice, you don't need a lot of it, just a tiny amount, is, quote, a pro-oxidant-antioxidant balance of those with metabolic syndrome, a cluster of symptoms associated with diabetes and cardiovascular disease. This is from the study. Quote, oxidative stress is an imbalance between the production of prooxidants and antioxidant defenses in favor of prooxidants. It is typically associated with augmented formation of reactive oxygen species. In lay language, it means this is part of, you're going to get older, you're going to get sicker, you're going to be diseased if you just have so much oxidative stress. Stress itself, psychological stress, creates oxidative stress. Not exercising enough, oxidative stress. Exercising too much, oxidative stress. Being in a polluted environment, oxidative stress. Being around electromagnetic pulses, computers, cell phones, microwaves, oxidative stress. So by taking saffron, it reduces that substantially. This was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial of people with metabolic syndrome, and they took 50 milligrams of saffron twice a day for 12 weeks. And they collected blood samples, and they analyzed them, and it made a big difference. So for all of you who've never tried saffron, I suggest you do. It's a wonderful spice. But also, if you're diabetic, definitely try it. And finally, green environments are very important, but this is about in your office. This is from Harvard School of Public Health and published in the Environmental Health Perspectives magazine. It says, people who work in well-ventilated offices with below-average levels of indoor pollutants and carbon dioxide have significantly higher cognitive function scores in crucial areas, such as responding to a crisis or developing strategy, than those who work in offices with typical levels. So this is a green versus non-green building, and this was a double-blind study. So what does this mean in lay language? What it means is that most people don't pay a lot of attention to the health of the environment in which they work. For example, do you have outgassing in your carpets? Indoor, outdoor carpets are almost always going to have glue resins that hold them down, and they're made of synthetic fibers, and they're protected from going bad by formaldehyde. So bad all the way around. Most of the desks and cabinets and offices are particle boards, and that's outgassing. And so you have all these outgassings that are dangerous and bad for us. We have very little windows that open anymore to give us fresh air, and we don't have air filtration systems. The overhead air filtration systems are functionally worthless. So make your work environment ventilated, put green plants in. The more green you have, the more plants you have in an office, the healthier it is. And that's also true at home as well. So that's what they were trying to say. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I don't have a guest today because I want to spend some time with some introspective commentaries that I believe will give us a little different perspective on some of the important issues of our time. I also want to mention that I look forward to this evening at 8 o'clock being at the ALBA, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, Human Rights, that's what ALBA stands for, Human Rights Documentary Film Festival. This is a very important film festival because it's all films about human rights. Mine is closing the festival at 8 o'clock, and then there'll be award ceremony and socializing afterwards. And I was just looking at their schedule today, and they've got Once Upon a Time There Was a Man. This is a remarkable story of a disabled entrepreneur and disabled rights activists who own the biggest baby shampoo factory in Iran, where more than 90% of the employees are disabled. That's one. They have another one, The Director's Hotel, about what happened in Libya after everything happened. There was a hotel that no one used, and yet the gardener stays there and had a chance The owners were gone. They were afraid of being killed. So there's no guest, but there's a manager and a gardener. And they saw all of the things happening through their eyes, all the conflicts. And another one is about Too Small to Swing a Cat, a 1935 film about housing problems depicting the conditions in the slums of London. And so that would certainly be interesting because rarely do we see anything like that. You know, there's all kinds, and then at 8 o'clock is Poverty, Inc. And so it's going to be at 211 East 49th Street at a major, very famous place between 2nd and 3rd Avenue. And if you want information, you can call 212-674-5398. Also, my lecture this Friday is full. So, but for those of you who were not able to get in, because I'm having a limited audience, because I can't use a microphone, I'm filming it. I will have the film done within about 3 months, and it's a very important film. I could use some people who have a car or a van, because starting at about 4 o'clock, we have to move our equipment from our office in mid-Manhattan to 86th Street, where the lecture is going to be. So you can call 646-926-5422 if you'd like to volunteer, and you will be able to get in and see the lecture. I'm concerned that the average person today may not fully appreciate how the major crash in 2007 occurred, 2007-2008, who was behind it, and how virtually all the major players not only got away with it, they actually became wealthier. Now, I just saw Coming Attraction with a new Brad Pitt film coming up that deals with that specific topic. I don't know. The film's not out yet. I'm looking forward to seeing it to see how accurate it is. But I wanted to share some very specific information with you. Then following that, I will have you listen to a short audio clip from a member of Congress on how a lot of people in Congress got extremely rich by being told in advance, 24 hours in advance, by the head of the Federal Reserve that the crash was coming. Now think of that for a moment. Members of Congress were brought into a secret meeting with the Federal Reserve. They were told the crash was coming. They had a chance to go back and start selling off their stocks in all banking institutions. And then 24 hours later, 48 hours later, the market had the worst day in its history. Those people who got out and shorted it made fortunes. And yet that was completely legal. And who was the lead person in that who made the most money, I believe? Nancy Pelosi. Did she have knowledge of this? You bet. Why are they allowed to get away with this? Why has this never been a point of discussion or contention? It should have been. So I just want you to know the other side of this. And we can thank J.P. Scottile for his in-depth and scholarly research that helps us on this. Because I've said many times, in fact, I just said yesterday on this program with Gerald Salante, that what we're not paying attention to in the United States is that we're riding up in bubbles. Now, we had the housing bubble. Well, we have another housing bubble, as if we didn't learn anything. We have an equity bubble. We have a student loan bubble. We have a credit card bubble. We have a corporate bubble. For example, corporate debt is over $26 trillion. Forget the federal deficit of $19.5 trillion. We have altogether over between the lowest figure I can come up with is $47 trillion. The highest is $156 trillion against our puny gross domestic product, which is shrinking. And the people on Wall Street who we were told we must save them. And I said, no, we shouldn't. And they said, if we go down, the entire world economy goes down. And I said, you're pathological liars. Your economy on Wall Street, all the banks, you should go through structured bankruptcy. If you really believe in the free market, then play by its rules. If you win ethically and honorably and legally, fine, the profit's yours. But if you lose, we, the American public on Main Street, should not bail you out. Then you're hypocritical. But that's all it's ever been. Trickle down? I've never seen anything trickle down. So they failed. They were poor administrators. They were poor at economics. They were poor at all the fundamentals. And yet they were paid an outrageous amount of money for failing upwards. You and I, we fail. We're small business people. We fail. The government's not going to help us. No one's going to help us. Now, every day, I take a long walk. I walk from 89th and Broadway down to Lincoln Center. And I count how many empty businesses there are. Then walk back up Amsterdam, and it's generally between the two streets. In that short period of on the Upper West Side, anywhere from 40 to 70 empty businesses. Not one of those businesses has helped. But if you're a big bank, and if you've been reckless and greedy and stupid, you'll definitely be helped. And no matter what illegalities you commit, your crimes will be forgiven, and you'll be made even wealthier. So that's the environment that we're looking at, one that's bad to the bone. And hence, it is all complicit, and it's all based upon debt. You see, my feeling is, if you are paying all of your bills with credit cards because you have no savings, and your weekly income is not adequate to have a savings so you can buy extra things, then that part of the gross domestic product that we count as prospering is not. It is an odd form of economic alchemy. You cannot say that your debt becomes America's good credit. It doesn't. A debt is a debt. So subtract that if you want to see how much are we really worth. And if you did that, unlike one time when Americans go out and spend money, and that money circulated as many as 57 times around a community, you bought some shirts. Okay, now the person who owned that store was able to pay their payroll, and those people went out and they went to a laundromat, they went to play bowling, they went to a drive-in movie, they went to dinner. They took. They bought new tires. Money circulates around an economy, but when Wall Street makes money, it doesn't circulate. It just goes to the hedge funds, the equity partnerships, and to their own private portfolios. So to have allowed Wall Street to fail would have been the most important economic adjustment, and it would have been nothing but healthy. Let the people who gambled, let the people who were greedy, let them suffer. Instead, everyone else suffered for their sins. Rather remarkable, isn't it? They didn't. Debt is one of the United States' most stringently enforced promises. At least that's true for those who cannot afford high-powered legal teams to fight it out in court. It's also true for the unfortunate many who don't work alongside revolving door regulators, who write and enforce the rules governing their wants and future employers. And it's most true for non-corporate persons who cannot dispatch legions of lobbyists to secure billion-dollar bailouts and rewrite laws. In the United States, all debtors are not created equal. The depth of that inequality emerged from the crash of 2008, capsized the American dream, as billions of dollars worth of promises suddenly came due. Now, it was quite obvious that the standards of enforcement of the captains of finance differ greatly from those applied to a multitude of drowning deckhands desperately clinging to life as their American dreams went underwater, meaning their homes. After all, do you remember growing up, if you were like me, a baby boomer in the 1950s and 60s, more often than not, your home didn't have a mortgage because it didn't cost much, and there was a 2% GI loan that our mothers and fathers were able to apply for and get, and we had savings. We didn't have credit cards, so if you couldn't afford something, you generally laid it away. Remember layaway plans where you could put something aside and pay a little bit on a regular basis, and by the time you paid it off, you can go and pick it up, and that was very reasonable. Well, that has been replaced by Black Fridays, where people are broke, don't have any savings, will push someone down, trample them to death to get a flat-screen TV that they don't need and put it on credit that they can't pay back. But now they're stuck in this repeating cycle, this loop of commodification, commercialization. And who allows that? They need that if you're a banker. Bankers need you not to pay your credit card debts on time. They don't make a profit from that. They need you to miss payments, be late on payments, and then the interest rate goes up, and that's how they make hundreds of billions of dollars. So what people had more than any other asset was their home. So if their home was worth $100,000 at one time, let's say in 2000, by 2007, it might be worth $300,000. So people started cashing out the equity in their homes thinking, this is all my money. No, it's not, because you took money from a bank, you gave them the lien on your house, and now you owe them back that money. So you just borrowed money from them, figuring, I don't have to pay it out of my own pocket because the value of my property is going to go up. I'll tell you how bad it was. I once had a conversation with someone I know in southern Florida where I told this person, sell everything you have, there's going to be a crash. Look at the bubble, it's going to burst. The person says, oh, nah. Man, you kidding? I can't. I got 12 properties out there. I said, what do you mean you have 12 properties? Well, I own 12 apartments over in South Beach, and I'm going to flip them, and I'm going to make over $1 million just this year. And I said, but what if you're wrong? What if the market crashes and there's no market for those? You're going to end up in debt, and the debt you can't walk away from, because the new rules are, if you walk away from a house, they can follow you. They can attach and garnish your wages. You can go to debtors' prisons, even though they're supposed to be outlawed. In 27 states, they have private debtors' prisons. And the person just laughed at me. He says, Gary, man, you're just being paranoid. 9 months later, the crash occurred. 3 months after that, I get a frantic call. I need some money. Will you loan me some money? What do you need money for? Man, I got all this stuff due, and they're calling it in because I had a lot of positions where I was leveraged to the max. And so they're asking for more down payment. And I said, you're going to go broke. You should declare bankruptcy because there's no way that you're going to be able to get out of this because this market's going to collapse. And it did. And the person learned nothing. Nothing at all. They're only angry I didn't give money. Friend, if you're not there to take my advice when I tell you what not to do, and you go ahead and do it, don't ask me for helping you out, because you didn't learn the lesson the first time. I'm not going to pay for your lesson. I believe people should pay for their own lessons if they intentionally and with complete conscious awareness, greed, decide to make a mistake. Then if someone else pays for your lesson, why are you going to pay for it? You have no downside. And we have a whole culture today of no one willing to pay for their own downside. No mistake. They don't want to pay for any mistake. So how are you going to prevent the mistake in the future? If you doubt me, be on the other side of this table. I'm counseling people who have yet to come to grips with the fact that they participated in their own disease. They don't want to acknowledge that more often than not. It's rare. So exactly how then are they going to prevent that from happening again? So then how are you really helping someone? Unless they get it and say, I made some bad choices and I've learned my lesson from those bad choices and I know now what not to do. Then you can help people. But that's rare. Just to understand this, the key difference between the housing bubble and the savings and loan crisis, during the savings and loan crisis, when people were quickly losing their savings and in many cases their life savings, the Federal Deposit and Insurance Corporation was there to cover up to $100,000 in losses. It buffered the impact of rampant speculation by the ironically named group of people who were the so-called thrifts. Well, there was nothing thrifty about the thrifts. After deregulation allowed them under Reagan, they played fast and loose with money deposited into their once state institutions. They looked at your money like, oh, I can go out and gamble with this now. No. That's people's hard-earned money. They're trusting you and your institution to keep it there, to protect it. I don't care if I don't make money. I don't want to lose money. And most people don't understand that rule. Right now, if you have money in a bank, you're losing money. You're not making money. Then why leave it in a bank? If that bank goes insolvent, your money that you had there, that you worked hard for your whole life, it becomes their money. Understand that you're bailing into these. You are given some kind of worthless certificate of whatever money they confiscate if that bank goes up. And you now own worthless paper. So I suggest you take your money out and put it in a safer place, unless you absolutely believe that the banking system is run wisely and run conservatively for the benefit of the investors. But Clinton, when he deregulated the banking system with the deregulating the Glass-Steagall Act, from that time till now, we've had nothing but massive, rampant speculation. And they're not using your money in your banks to build factories, to bring work to Americans, to give people a living wage, to reinstitute a whole Buy America program. They're not doing that. They're putting the money to work for themselves. And yet when this financialized bubble burst, there wasn't an FDIC guarantee to buoy average Americans and keep them from going underwater on their mortgages. The FDIC doesn't do that, nor does it bail out average Americans when they lose their 401k retirement dreams or mutual fund investments when the market tanks, like it did during the dot-com crash and after the housing bubble burst. Nope, the average American loses their wealth and had to keep their debt promises, and many handed over their American dream, their house, or co-op during the ensuing foreclosure crisis. And that's how it went. And this time, there would be no appetite for prosecutions. No, Bernanke and all the other people within the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve, they didn't want to see any of the people on Wall Street go to jail, and hence none did, or be brought up on crimes, and none were. And the White House wasn't going to do it. There was no relief for the middle class. There was no relief for the working class. But maybe I missed it. Maybe the President of the United States and Congress got together and say, look, we've got tens of millions of Americans who are suffering. They have lost a lot. Let's keep them in their homes. Let's have a moratorium on all home foreclosures and bring the cost of their mortgages down to where they're paying only 15% of their income. Therefore, even the poorest American at that point could stay in their home and still be a vital part of their community. No, we didn't see that. The president, Congress, no, Washington, the media didn't even want to touch that topic. That was a third rail. Compassion for average people. But boy, did they rush to put their shoulders against the wall to make sure that the big banking institutions didn't fail. And big banker says, remember, we're too big to fail. No, they weren't. That has been a lie. They should have been taken apart piece by piece. So what we have now is we have in the post-dot-com 9/11 era of uncertainty, the huge majority of debt-addled, yield-hungry Americans sought security. And if you're in Wall Street, it's pure greed. And when the next correction comes, it's going to be massive. So owning a home was the next best thing. But that's fine if you owned a home without going into deep debt on it, as long as you could afford a mortgage. The trouble is we want something and we want it now. We don't care if we should wait a year or five. We are a nation of impatient people. We want something. We have urges. We have desires. We have dreams. Don't interfere with that by prudent and reasonable and cautionary discipline. And as a result, we just invested in everything we wanted to invest in, whether it was realistic or not. And when we were told to lie about our income, we did. And they did. And there wasn't one in 99. It was a whole country gone crazy. Eager Americans poured wealth into the housing market. That influx stoked a profitable frenzy in mortgage securitization, erotic financialization, and derivative deal-making. Even worse, the predatory subprime lending boom had a self-reinforcing effect on the bubble by warping supply through stoking demand and competition for houses. I remember people saying, you better get over here with a check, but I haven't even seen the place yet. Doesn't matter. It's going to go. And sure enough, it would. Because people kept thinking about how much more they were going to make, how much more they were going to make. Why haven't we ever had a conversation upon what role does the average American play in the choices they made, the minds that they had of thinking that their American dream would come at a discount price and there was going to be a shortcut to the process? We haven't had that conversation. We should. And Wall Street saw it, they exploited it, and people participated. As a result, we ended up with debt, artificially fueling spending and speculation, even as the fallout from the last bubble, the dot-com bubble, was still being sorted out. So how does this play out? Well, it means today that we have more than 150 million Americans who cannot pay their bills with any savings because they have none. That if these individuals don't have an income or some money coming in on a weekly basis, they just cannot survive. But we also have a big problem, and for me it's a big problem, and that is people who have gotten credit cards by these very mercenary companies and banks and are encouraging people to buy what they certainly don't need and can't afford. And so that has caused an enormous amount of credit card debt. In fact, the average American has 6 credit cards, and the amount that they're giving you is more and more. Like it used to be in 2003, your limit was $3,500 on each credit card. Today, it's over $10,000. So just imagine how much bills you can run up. And remember, they make their money when you can't make your payments, you have to make partial payments, or you miss a payment. And everyone was aware of this, and everyone exploited it. Because everyone thought that everyone should buy whatever they saw on television or they wanted. So that's where we got there. There was a feeding frenzy. And then we gave the special people options. Do you remember where we were told that there would be a limit to how much we would give the banks? And they all met and said, yeah, we're going to give them so many billions of dollars. But turns out that they lied. They actually gave $3.42 trillion, and a lot of that was in secret. And then other $7.17 trillion was given out just in the first quarter. And as a result, massive amounts are guaranteed up through the first quarter of 2015. So think of that. Now, that made those banks who had made mistake richer. So what did they do? They turned around and bought other banks. So the strong sharks ate the small sharks. And so they were looking for a nosebleed everywhere because they never had to invest their own money. They were broke. They were dead broke. And yet they got the government, the Federal Reserve, to give them huge, unlimited, virtually unlimited amounts of money they could then invest in foreign currencies where they could make a big profit. All the while, they got bigger and bigger. Did they get smarter? No. Did they reform anything? There's been no reform. But they also made sure that if you or I, if we can't pay our bills, we're punished. We'll have our salaries attached, liens put on our homes. If you're a student, you cannot get out of that debt. It'll follow you for decades. And if you had a father or grandfather or grandmother sign for your college tuition, they're personally responsible. They'll take their pensions. Yeah, they do that. Debtors' prisons are going to be full in the next 5 years. They'll have to be building dozens more to handle all the students who stopped paying their bills. One student who stopped for 6 months paying their student loan in California had 12 members fully armed of SWAT team raid the house, broke down the door looking for the person. They were going to be arrested because they didn't pay their bills. So that brings us to this. Here we have the people who caused the problem profiting from it. They're bigger, they're wealthier, they're more powerful. They then pay the legislators who keep them in power. They pay everyone that is important to them. We're not. We're the people that have to spend money into their system for them to have control over us. So when you buy a house, you buy an apartment because you're sure it's going to go up. When you buy something using their credit card because you're sure you need it, maybe you do, maybe you don't. they're still in power. The only way to take back power is to stop supporting them. Stop supporting everything they're about. Take your money out of their banks. Turn off their television programs, radio programs. Stop buying their clothes made in Bangladesh. Stop eating their genetically engineered food. Stop voting Democrat or Republican, because it doesn't matter. You're getting corporate either way, the people behind this. And then you can start realizing what's really important. And that American dream was never a dream in the last 40 years. It was their way of making us believe through their illusion and their eyes that we needed that. We didn't. Now, for our stations around the country, I'm going to play this little segment from Congress. It's short. You need to hear it because you have to know how utterly vile and corrupt morally our legislators are, who knew the crash was coming, did not warn us, but they exploited it for their own financial needs.
It's so interesting because so much of the focus on members of Congress is what their salaries are. And people, I think, legitimately get upset that they're being paid, you know, $150,000, $175,000. The fact of the matter is that the salary is sort of the floor of what they can make.
A very profitable income-earning opportunity for members of Congress is through initial public offerings, or IPOs. Companies might offer legislators a chance to buy stock when it is first made available, a time when its price per share is potentially set to skyrocket. 14-term California Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi got special access to purchase Visa stock on March 18, 2008, the day before it was made available to the public.
Visa took Wall Street by storm today with the largest initial public offering in history.
It was one of three trades on Visa she made that year, totaling between $1 and $5 million. Visa's stock price jumped 50% in just 2 days. The timing of that IPO access coincided with House legislation that Visa strongly opposed. Pelosi, the speaker at the time, never allowed the legislation to the floor for a vote.
You know, if I came into your office and you're a senator and I gave you a shoebox with $10,000 cash and wanted a favor in return, if we got caught, we're both going to jail. If I come into your office as a senator and I want a favor and instead I give you access to pre-initial public offering stock that's going to make you $100,000 in a day, that's completely legal. And that's what makes the IPO approach so brilliant and so troubling.
And no congressman has ever been prosecuted for insider trading, even though they have extraordinary access to valuable information. This was the case on September 16, 2008. Congressional leaders met with Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, and for the first time, learned how bad the financial crisis could be. In his book, Peter Schweitzer reported that the next day, at least 10 senators made trades on financial stocks and funds while the public was still largely in the dark. Congresswoman Shelley Capito, who sits on the House Financial Services Committee, dumped more than $100,000 of Citigroup stock. Congressman Jim Moran sold stock in more than 90 different companies, his busiest trading day of the year. All those trades were made just 12 days before the biggest single-day crash in market history, and 1 week before Moran took to the House floor to say this.
Mr. Speaker, greed is the accelerator that drives a capitalist economy. But unless you're willing to tap on the regulatory brakes once in a while, you're going to crash.
After Schweitzer's book, Throw Them All Out, brought Congress's use of that private information into the spotlight, a 60-minute story apparently forced lawmakers to pass the Stock Act in 2012. With great fanfare, they agreed to stop trading on insider knowledge and even set up a database to publicly disclose all of their trades.
There you go. Yeah.
However, 1 year later, representatives quietly rolled back many of those disclosure requirements, and special access to initial public offerings was never deemed illegal for members of Congress.
Everybody knows this requires the Securities and Exchange Commission to enforce these laws. Well, the SEC's budget is written by Congress. SEC commissioners are appointed by the U.S. Senate. Everybody knows that the SEC is not going to go after the people that are setting their budget. So it's an example of them going through the motions of reform, but in fact of matter, it really doesn't mean anything.
One solution? Why not the American public join together and ask for forgiveness for all interest on all debt? One time, credit card debt, student debt, allow students to go through bankruptcy to discharge that debt, and then see how that helps millions, tens of millions of Americans get back up on their feet. And then close down these payday loan companies and cap interest for any credit card or any transaction at 1%. Close the Federal Reserve. Give the Treasury back the right to print money at no interest. Forgive all debt, including all bank debt. That saves us over $600 billion a year right there. We did it for all these corporations. Why can't we do it for the average person? I'm Gary Noll. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day. I don't care about your past.